If you had asked me, without, you know, in looking at any sources, let's say somebody is no interest whatsoever in studying the Torah, but they pray. So if you'd ask me what's the value of that, so I'd say, you know, we're a religion that believes in partial credit. I mean, we do. You know, nobody's perfect, so we're all in the business of accepting partial credit, and as well we should be. So I would say, okay, so they're missing a linchpin for sure. But look, you know, Shlosh Dvarim Ha'olam Omed, it's true, Torah, Avoda, Gemilas Chasadim. So I would say, you know, Avoda, we usually understand that to mean Tefillah, so they're missing the Torah part, but they daven, what's wonderful. After all, the famous statement of Chazal in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Rachmana Liba Ba'i, that over and above everything else, God desires a person's heart, feeling impassioned religious experience. So, you know, I would say it's not the ideal. It's really severely lacking in this crucial area. But at the end, you have to give credit where credit is due. You have to be fair-minded about it. It's a lot better than if they didn't study and didn't pray. So it's in that connection that I wanted to discuss what, therefore, first time you look at it, appears to be a very puzzling, there's no other word for it, Pasuk in Mishlei. Pasuk says as follows, Meisir ozno mishmoa Torah, one who removes his ear from listening to Torah. In other words, not just that he doesn't study, but he's not into it. Meisir ozno mishmoa Torah, gam tfilaso toeva. So his prayer is also an abomination. Wow. So, you know, like I say, whatever happened to partial credit? It's just, you know.
But I thought even if you were in the shul and they read the Torah, that was like part of study.
Yeah, that's all. Intent, that's also true. Yeah, yeah, sorry.
Intent
go ahead.
In Judaism isn't as important as action. I mean, as
yeah,
what
so
you do regardless of what your intent.
So I think
is.
What Gladys is saying is that look, you know, he in the end of the day, the person prayed. So, you know, why can't they just get partial credit here? Why are we prepared to throw out their prayer as well?
I think it's even worse. I mean, I think someone could come into a shul and the first thing you do is you pray. Now, that's the building blocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's like people are kosher before they're Shomrei Shabbos. You never heard of a person who's Shomrei Shabbos and not kosher. I mean,
that's,
it's.
Yeah,
I mean,
you,
there,
right.
There are certain building blocks that build up to the final stage. I mean, I
but
think
if somebody prays it's and doesn't take the next step up, it's an abomination.
Well, if they don't, but
no.
At the beginning it takes time. But it takes time
to
get to that stage.
I thought that praying and listening to hear the Torah
like that very much.
Didn't exclude studying.
Yeah, they are intertwined the way that we practice them. So just to go back to what Arthur was saying is that I agree. There's simply no way that we can conceive of this pasuk as referring to somebody who's just starting out, and I don't think it can, because if you read it closely, it's meisir ozno mishmo Torah. This is only talking about one who actively removes himself, but somebody who is, you know, uninitiated. Somebody who simply is not exposed yet to study, of course, prayer, the gates of prayer are, you might say, poetically, much broader than the gates of study. Before anybody, you know, it takes a long time to get to the point where one can enjoy study. I mean, just, you know, it's difficult, and any intellectual activity at first it's difficult to enjoy. They say you can't really enjoy something until you master it. I don't know if that's true, but until you have some degree of proficiency with it. So, but prayer is something which can be a very cathartic experience, can be a very deep experience. So I totally agree with Arthur. I think at the very least, we have to say that... here you go, Brian. Oh, there's one down there. Okay. So at the very least, we have to say that this can't be referring to somebody who's never been exposed to Torah, and that, in fact, is what the Pasuk indicates. It's only a meisir ozno mishmo Torah. But nonetheless, even if you have somebody, let's just say, you know, we all know people like this. Obviously, I'm, you know, preaching to the choir here. These are people who, you know, come of their own volition to study, which is an amazing and remarkable thing. And, you know, that should go on the record. Is that, you know, nonetheless, it's striking. You know, you have people who gravitate towards different aspects of their religious experience. You have some people who are really into chesed. You have some people who are really into learning. You have some people who are really into davening. You have some people who are really into all three. And isn't that wonderful? But somebody who's into davening, but you know, just isn't into Torah learning. I think we've all encountered people like that. So the idea that gam tfilaso toeva, I think it should shock us. I don't think, how could we accept that? Yeah, Mrs. Winter.
I'm not sure I'm right, but the Hasidism started with people who didn't know how to study.
That's right.
But wanted to say something from the heart. Like Bar Shem Tov said, if we dance and we sing and we say for the Shabbat like Kala and go to the end of the village, and that's the same thing like to learn. And that's when they separated themselves from the Mishnagedim, who was very important to study of the Torah, and the Hasidism, who really did study but sing and dance.
Mrs. Winter, what you said is exactly correct. I didn't even think of it to bring up, but it's actually so apropos. So just I'm sure many people are familiar with the basics of what Mrs. Winter outlined, but Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, the position of Chazal, was that the most prized, and we'll have to discuss a little bit about why this should be so. It's not necessarily intuitive. If you're asking somebody to start, you know, a moral system from scratch, they might say chesed is the most important thing. But Talmud Torah has this totally singular place. And it was prized historically. I mean, the Jewish community was built around it. And then, of course, anytime you put an intellectual activity at the center of an experience, it, by very definition, is elitist.
Yeah,
it's always going to be. Why? Because only a certain amount of people can really do it in the most excellent way. So what about everybody else? And there's always this tension. The more you want to emphasize Talmud Torah, the more you're going to be sacrificing the masses for a small group of people at the top. That's a fact of life. So you have this whole Hasidic movement, which is not going to be our topic for now, but just to mention quickly where the emphasis was put on what they referred to as dveikus, sort of cleaving a more emotive, emotional, religious experience, experiential Judaism. And, of course, this was seen as not only a threat to the primacy of Talmud Torah, of study, but a threat to the primacy of halacha itself. And the more one emphasizes what, you know, could be called in a somewhat derogatory fashion an orgiastic, experiential religious life, the less grounded it is, the less normative it is, and even halachot, which weren't, you know, that crucial, and again, I don't want to sit here and pick and choose, but they became major flashpoints. So Hasidim, to this day are famous or infamous, depending on which quarters you come from. My family has its roots in the Lithuanian tradition. That's where we're from. But some of my best friends are Hasidim. So that's not even true, I don't think. But what I mean to say is that I don't think so. So, but the point really is things like Zmanei Tfila, the Hasidim, they say, oh, they'll daven whenever. So those things became major flashpoints because what they stood for was symbolic of how much should we put law at the center. So that's a great example of this issue of, what about all the people there who, either haven't been exposed to learning, that was Arthur's point, or people who are just not that good at it. They're just not that good at it. They never enjoyed academic disciplines to begin with. It's always a struggle. This Pasuk in Mishlei is using strong terms. A to'eva is an abomination. That's not a neutral term. And it's not a compliment either. So, we have to be struck by that.
Is there any other translation of that word?
There really isn't. Toeva.
These words that have different.
No, toeva. Toeva is like loud and clear. Toeva is with a capital T. Really bad news. So, this is a shocking pasuk. So the first approach I wanted to discuss, though, we're going to have to work our way through these sources, is from the Yalkut Shimoni. The Yalkut Shimoni basically interprets it as follows. That a Meser Azno Mishmoa Torah is not somebody who's not academically oriented in general. We wouldn't be so critical of that person. But rather, it's somebody who is dismissive. Shelo Tomru Eshtaked Shemanu Ota. A person shouldn't say, oh, listen, that you're hearing a Dvar Torah for the second time. So let's say, comes to Hanukkah and somebody starts a Dvar Torah. Now, why is it that they celebrated for 8 days? The first day wasn't a miracle. it was enough to last the first day. The 7 days should be for seven. Now everybody's, you know, most people have heard that question before, so now you tune out. So the Yalkut Shimoni speaks very critically of that. V'imam artem kach, so if you start tuning out and say, well, I have nothing left to learn, so Hashem says, afani yachol lomar lachem, lama tem korim et shema pamayim b'yom, lama tem ispalim shlosha pamim yom, shema atem b'chad shem davar, im ga'altem b'divrei Torah, af ani eini shomea tfilaschem, shenemar meisir ozno mishmo Torah gam tfilaso toeva, which basically means, if you tell Hashem about his Torah, so to speak, you know, okay, I heard it once before, I don't need to hear it again, then Hashem says to you, oh, that Shmon Esrei that you just recited where you asked for this, that, and the other, I think I've heard that one before too. Like at Shachris. Or like yesterday. Or like from the guy next door. I think I can, you know, pretty much see where this one is going. This guy is going down the, I could really use a raise road. Okay, I've seen that one before. So the idea here is to limit the scope of the pasuk. Meisir ozno mishmo Torah is only referring to somebody who's dismissive in general, not to somebody who's sincere and well-meaning, and you know, and does his best, but somebody who's dismissive of Torah study when it's being repeated. So Hashem says, your tfilos are not of interest to me, because by definition, tfila is something that's going to be repetitive. We have the same structure. So if you take this approach, you're able to, at least to a certain extent, ameliorate the problem that we started with, was how could we be so caustic, critical of people who are not Torah-centered in their religious observance. Okay.
But there's Torah in praise itself.
Yeah, most of tefillah is based on Tanakh.
Right. You know, and
100%. So it really means that he doesn't put the study of Torah in the rigorous sense. I mean, clearly there's going to be, and I think that's what I think Susan was pointing that out before, is that we even read the Torah, you know, Sunday, Shabbos afternoon. The person himself. In other words, the person by.
No, who is calling it an abomination?
Oh, this is Shlomo. Shlomo in Mishlei refers to it as, this is from the, let me just put that on the record, it's the 28th chapter of Mishlei, the 9th pasuk. Okay, so to take things one step further, the Medrash Mishlei says as follows, this is the third source. Amar of Chanin, Nemir Khan Meser Azno Mishmoa Torah, says one who removes his ear from listening to Torah, he's not interested in what the Torah has to say. Ulahalan hu omer otem ozno mizakas dal, and then later on it says one who averts his ear from the cry of the poor. So malahalan gam hu yikra velo yana afkan tfilaso toeva. So the result is the same. So just as one, get this comparison. It's very fascinating, I think pretty deep. So just as one who disregards the cry of the needy, his prayers are not answered. So too, one who is unwilling to listen to the Torah, so his prayers should not be answered either. So of course, to begin with, we understand the former very well. We say, if you're not going to be compassionate, so why should Hashem be compassionate with you? But what needs a little further explanation is, why should it be that somebody who's not interested in learning Divrei Torah should have his prayers go unanswered? So I think the common denominator here is what I would call a kind of selfish orientation, a selfish religious orientation. Somebody who asks but isn't willing to give. Somebody who demands but is not willing to be demanded of. Which is to say, both in the interpersonal realm, somebody demands from God but he's not willing to give to others. Or in, you know, Bein Adam L'Makom, he asks many things of God but he doesn't accept that God can ask anything of him. So that's a kind of selfish orientation. That's another way of understanding this pasuk. In other words, the pasuk isn't talking about people who aren't, you know, Torah-centered in the academic sense. The Mishlei is speaking about people who are selfish. People who are unwilling to accept the notion of being asked from and insist on being takers. Okay, so if you take that approach also, then you can sort of limit the damage that this pasuk would otherwise do, and the amount of work that we'd have to do to explain it. But as you move along in the various interpretations, you start to encounter what seemed to be closer to the pshat of the pasuk. We take a look here. This is also from the Medrash in Mishlei. Meisir ozno mishmoa Torah, Amar Rav Huna, kol mi she'ein chavivin alav divrei Torah, Gam tfilaso toeva. Wow! There you have it. So somebody who, you know, the words of Torah are not beloved to them, so his prayer is an abomination. So, you know, we can all shudder, because I think we've all had the experience, you know, we're not proud of it, but, you know, where we did, you know, days or minutes or hours that we might describe ourselves in this category as Ein Chaviven Alav Divrei Torah, that we weren't exactly in the mood to hear a shir or to study for an hour or two or however long. So tfilaso toeva? Like I say, you know, it's to scratch our heads a little bit and maybe even shudder. Yeah, Susan, go ahead, please.
But I'm just thinking of another thing too. In the time that this was written,
in Mishlei, you mean?
Yeah, Mishlei was written. Yeah. There weren't quite as many distractions in the life of people as there are now.
Interesting.
So these words say, well, you know, what is it that you were doing that was so important that you couldn't study? Or what is it that you were doing that you didn't love Torah? You know, what was so important? You know, not that we couldn't say it today, but we could say it any time we want to say it. But, I mean, but life held a lot less distraction than it did now. I mean, you worked, you prayed, you when, you know, I mean, it was a different...
So, Susan puts her finger on something which I think is... I think, like, so let's say if I had 24 hours, you know, say I could hire an assistant to do all my things. I would like to think about this, like, all day. Because I've thought about this a lot before, and I think it go both ways. What Susan is saying, I definitely agree with in part, meaning when you have laptops and iPhones and everything else... it's extremely difficult to do concentrated academic activity because our brains are just basically shot from instantaneous stimulation. So the idea of concentrating on a text for any length of time is just extraordinarily difficult. Now, what this means for 20 years from now, none of us have any clue because it's never happened before. So there's no question that there's a certain kind of distraction that exists today by virtue of technology, that a certain intensity, a certain kind of distraction, which is new. On the other hand, I think this is what Brian, and then I want to take what Brian says, because I saw Brian maybe has a different approach here. There are at least two points which have to be raised. First of all, there are tremendous pressures that existed then. I mean, certain comforts that we have by virtue of technology that they didn't have.
They didn't have electricity. That changed the whole world.
Bingo.
Yeah. I mean, really.
So that took away the night.
The day ended at night, unless you want to stand with a candle flickering. You couldn't read. I mean,
that's number one. That's what I'm going to say. So the same way that technology is, technology taketh, but technology giveth.
That's right.
You know, so that's, and not only that, but, you know, forget about the light itself is crucial, as Arthur is saying. But let's say you lived in, you know, Northern Europe. We were just talking about Northern Eastern Europe. It'd be really cold. A lot. So it would be hard to do things.
And the night ended, you know, when? 4 o'clock, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
You know,
in those places. And it didn't resume right to 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock the next morning.
So that's a huge piece of it, is that they were operating with challenges we didn't have. The second thing that I would say, and it's related to the first point, but it's slightly distinct, is life expectancy. It's true that we have many more distractions in the immediate sense, but they didn't get anywhere near the amount of time. You know, there was this no idea of, people living, thank God, you know, what can we say? So, you know, in terms of if you want to net the amount of time, you know, we're probably in a better position than they were. Yeah, Brian.
Yeah, yeah, the same thing. Every task was so much more difficult. Yeah. Washing was, it took days.
Right.
You know, making bread took days.
Well, you know, when I got married, my grandmother said something. She said, when we were younger, everything was very much more difficult. She said, but that was all we were expected to do. She said, you have it more difficult because you're expected to do everything.
Huh.
I'll play it on the record. I have the record when she said that.
Oh, you have the...
Yeah, they recorded
We have to need to bring that in.
Yeah.
And a record player.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's okay. So, but anyway, what Susan's saying is really interesting. In other words, that this is a very harsh stand, but it's a harsh stand that is a product of, let's say, higher expectations. And today, we might have mitigated expectations, and that's why I think it's such a fascinating topic, is to go back and forth about all the differences, all the similarities and the differences, and it's just so difficult to compare from one generation to the next. But again, so just getting back to the text here, Amar Rav Huna kol she'ein chaviv in alav divrei Torah, gam tefila so toeva. So, I mean, how are we meant to relate to this? So, clearly, there is something unexpected here. Something which is jarring, but it does open up a vista, which is that so much of religious experience, especially in Eastern cultures, it's crept into Jewish practice as well. Mrs. Winter makes an excellent point in terms of bringing up the historical precedent of the Hasidic movement, of Hasidism. It is the notion of a kind of religious experience which is not grounded first and foremost in relating to God as the commander, as the source of law. In Ish Halacha, in Halachic Man, the Rav writes with great elegance about exactly this idea, that the essence of Jewish religious experience is being commanded, is the actualization of the halachic ideals, a kind of pristine mathematical structure of halachic ideals, which is an a priori system. And there's a system of certain values which are encapsulated in the halacha, and the job of a religious Jew, what the religious Jewish experience is all about, is bringing those into the world. The process of being commanded and the true experience and worth of Judaism is living out those timeless ideals that are encapsulated in the halacha. A totally normative-centric experience, which is why he called it the halachic man. And there, in that essay, for those who recall, or those who may have heard of it, he contrasts what he refers to as the ish halacha, the halachic man, with homo religiosus, which is a Latin term for religious man. Religious man being experience-driven, trying to cleave to God, not in a normative sense, not through a certain constellation of ideal laws, the halachic system, but through all manner of extreme practices, fasting, and all kinds of what's referred to throughout that essay, kind of trying to experience God, but not through any kind of legal or normative system. So here you have these midrashim sort of touching on that. It's a person who would attempt to build a relationship with God through the means of prayer alone, and prayer as a symbolic gesture of a kind of, emotional bond, but without the framework of Torah, without a normative legal framework. So we consider that kind of prayer an abomination because of, in my view, the presumptuousness of it. You are not an equal with God. This is not a conversation that you can have absent the notion of God as commander-in-chief, normative law, a framework. He's not just your father, but he is, after all, Avinu Malkeinu. He is the Melech, he is the Mitzaveh. And so this Medrash in Mishle bespeaks a kind of normative-centric Judaism that's, of course, reflected by the primacy of Talmud Torah. What is Talmud Torah if not studying first and foremost, I mean, it's many things, but first and foremost, God's commands, that it is that which God demands from man. So Amar Rav Huna, kol mi she'ein chaviv in alav divrei Torah, gam tefila so toeva. One can't have a meaningful prayer experience that isn't first built on the idea of God as the commander. So that's a striking position. That's a uniquely Jewish approach to the religious experience. And as I mentioned, if there's one thinker, one book that really captures it, it's Rav Soloveitchik's Halachic Man, which speaks about this at great length. But it even goes further than that. I mean, so much for the establishing the centrality of norms, legal norms, rules in Judaism. I mean, you know, at least the early Christians got this right. You know, if you read through the Gospels, the basic critique of the Gospels is Judaism has all these rules. So whether or not that's a justified critique, we'll have to disagree with them on you know, whether it's with merit. But we can't fault them for describing it improperly. There are all these rules. It's true. So the Rav is trying to argue that that's man's way of relating to God, man's way of transcending his temporal tragic, what the Rav refers to as his tragic, man's tragic place in the world. The redeeming a broken life is through something transcendent. And what is transcendent but law? Okay, so they were correct in terms of pointing that out. The question is, what's the significance of that? So they felt that that crushed man's spirit, and the Rav was trying to argue that that redeemed and ennobled man's spirit. But it even goes further than that. In other words, let's say one accepts the normative yoke, the idea that religion should be experienced primarily as we are the commanded. We are not ones to be so presumptuous as to question God's will or God's wisdom, as God said to Job on that fateful day, when, you know, after all the you know, complaints, and we can commiserate with Job. He says, "Where were you when I created the world?" In other words, this is not a fair conversation. You know, you're not coming in here with the same knowledge that I have, so you can't even begin to perceive my design. And the only way we can even try to relate to that conversation is by thinking a little bit. It's like when the child says to their grandparents, you know, "Grandma, you don't understand anything," and the grandmother doesn't even have the language to say how little the child understands. Imagine you can multiply that by some massive number, and then you get Hashem's conversation with Eov. So, let's say one does accept the normative yoke. What then is the interrelationship between study and prayer? So there is a shocking Gemara. And the reason that I bring up this Gemara is because this is the only Gemara in the entire Babylonian Talmud which makes reference to our Pasuk in Mishlei, the Pasuk that we're studying tonight. So the Gemara, you have it here in Source 5, but I'll just describe it outside because it's better if you describe it in a story, because it really happened as a story. So Rava saw Rav Hamnuna davening. Okay, so then Rava, you know, presumably they were in a base medrash somewhere, Rava kept on learning, then he looks up again, and Rav Hamnuna is still davening. Mm. He's, whatever it goes back to studying, just this guy won't stop davening. We've all seen that. So he just eventually says, either to himself or out loud, he says, you know, "What's up with Rav Hamnuna? Manichin chaye olam ve'oskin b'chaye shah." You know, he's so immersed in temporal life, davening chayisha, and Rashi explains, because what's davening all about? God send me a refuah shleima, God send me a parnasa, bring peace to the world. You know, 4 days ago, I was reading an article about this. It strikes me as trivial, but again, you know, who am I to judge her? This is the Giants, one of the Giants' owners, I think her name is Ann Mara. Right. She's a very devout woman. Yeah. And so it's just, you know, she was praying during the fourth quarter that God should, you know, lift the Giants and give Eli, you know, whatever it is. And I don't mean to trivialize, you know, there are obviously things that are much more important than praying for the Giants. We're, of course, very happy that they won. You know, these are significant human needs, but nonetheless, they're human needs. They don't relate to eternal truth. They're means to an end. So health is crucial, because without health, I mean, we don't need to say.
Yeah, but our prayers, the Shema Nesra especially, give me this and give me this.
Exactly. Give me. Exactly. So that's his critique. He says, this guy is all he wants. He's davening forever. Give me this, give me that, give me this. Get back to Torah study. Get back to what he refers to as Chai Olam. Something which is eternal, something which is, as we call, it's an ideal system which transcends the world. You know, the Chazal always speak about God looking into the Torah and creating the world. And it's the Torah preceding the world, it being a system of ideal truths, what Rabbi Soloveitchik referred to as mathematical truths that aren't limited by this world. Again, the job of the halachist is to apply them to this world. But they're ideal truths. They transcend any what you're having for dinner tonight. They transcend your cold. They transcend everything. So this guy won't stop davening. What's wrong with him? Davening has its place, but it's totally overwhelmed by the centrality of Torah study, which is engagement in an ideal system, an eternal system. And then the Gemara has to defend Rav Hamnuna. So the Gemara says, Rav Hamnuna felt Zman Tfila Lachud, Zman Torah Lachud. basically, there's a time for davening and there's a time for learning. So leave me alone. You know, I want to daven. I need to daven. Okay, so here you have it. In other words, what this Gemara isn't about two people, one of whom denies the centrality of Torah study. These are two Amorayim, whose contributions are all over Shas. These were legal giants. But even amongst them, you have a little bit of a difference in emphasis, or a lot of a difference in emphasis, in terms of the relative hierarchy of values. Rava is saying, you know, there's got to be a limit. You know, how long can you stand there and talk about what in the end are temporal issues when you're actively neglecting that which is of crucial importance? Remember, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, Torah study, and you know, Rav Hamnuna apparently just didn't see it that way. You can say, you know, different religious personalities, you know, different emphases. Okay, but then the Gemara goes on even further. So if you take a look, let's just go ahead to source 8. You know, the Meiri, just summarize it outside. The Meiri quotes that he says, you know, the what emerges from this Gemara, this story of Rava and Rav Hamnuna, is that if a person is in the middle of learning and they have to stop to daven, they should, you know, they shouldn't go on forever. They should daven and get back to business. So he really does say that, almost like taking sides with Rava. But then the Gemara goes on to say as follows. And if you thought the previous story was a little extreme, that Rava was getting a little worked up, you know, in the end of the day, what was he doing? He was davening, you know. He was, you know, Rava was getting all excited about that. So listen to this. Rabbi Yirmiyah, this is source 8, Rabbi Yirmiyah hava yasiv kami de Reb Zeira havu asku b'shmaisis. Rabbi Yirmiyah and Reb Zeira were basically having a chavrusa, and they were really into it. Naga litzluye, which Rashi interprets to mean they realized that they were late for davening. Vihu kamisarhev v'havakamisarhev Reb Yirmiyah. So Reb Yirmiyah starts rushing out to catch davening before it's too late. So kariyale Reb Zeira. So Reb Zeira yells at him for, you know, rushing out. This is the way Rashi reads the Gemara. I'm not making it up. Meser osmo mishmoa Torah gam tvilaso toeva. This Reb Yirmiyah, who turns his ears away from Torah, even his prayer. He's running out to daven. He thinks it's such a great... Even his prayer is an abomination. Oh my goodness. This is considered turning your ear away from Torah study? The man was learning all day. He's taking a 10-minute mincha break because he doesn't want to miss mincha. And he's being told that his prayer is going to be an abomination? This sounds like one of these horror stories from yeshiva. And I just wanted to daven, and then he told me that I was going to be a toeva.
Well, Rabbi Rakovsky was once saying,
oh my God,
that which yeshiva, he says, you think people daven fast here? He says, you should see how they daven this yeshiva, because they go through it at lightning speed because they feel it's taking away from Torah study. Right, and he says, you wouldn't believe how quickly they daven.
Here, says Reb Zeira. That's what Reb Zeira was saying.
Did he think it was a good thing?
In other words, whose side was he on? Rabbi Yirmiyah or Rav Zeira? Rava, Rav Hamnuna?
Is anybody passing value judgments on this?
Look at.
No,
they call something an abomination.
No. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the commentators on the commentators.
Right.
I'm sure you're getting to it.
Right, exactly. I mean, what you're seeing here is already in the Amoraim themselves, these radically different perspectives, where they were very critical of each other. They're yelling at each other about this. Remember the first story, Rav Hamnuna is davening for too long, and Rava says, it's out of control. Stop davening for Refuah Shleima and start learning Torah. You know, I put it bluntly, but that's basically what happened to Gemara. And then the second source is, you know, they're learning. This is the way Rashi reads the Gemara. Rav Zeira is late for davening, and he goes out the door to daven, and you know, Reb Zeira calls after him that your tefillah is going to be a toeva, which is, you know, not a pep talk.
Today's world, I think that...
Susan, go ahead, please.
No, I think that the time for davening is emphasized. I mean, in schools, for kids, they're studying and they're learning, and all of a sudden it's time for mincha.
Right.
And you stop. I mean, you know, when you're older, this is the time you have to say mincha, whatever time the minyan is, and you stop.
Correct.
So, I mean, it seems to me, to answer your question, that, you know, when you're in the yeshiva world, or when you're in the Talmud, whatever world you're learning, you know, you could be critical, but when you're in the general world, it seems to me that the authorities are saying dominance.
So Susan's distinction is already present in the Talmud itself. So what Susan is saying is that you basically have to make a distinction based on context. And the way that a lot of the commentaries, is in response to Ellen's question, deal with this issue is that you could, this is only conceivable for people who are under a category that we don't have anymore, which is called Toraso Umnaso. Their Torah is their way of life, not just their livelihood, but they're so immersed in it, they're so involved in it, as they don't take a break for anything. And so we have the story of Rabbi Yehuda, who was the Amora who used to daven once every 30 days. You know, I've mentioned here in the past. Because he didn't take a break for anything. So if you're learning literally 24-7, so then you can have this conversation. But in the normal course of human affairs, sounds like the Declaration of Independence, you know, in the course of human affairs, the normal course of human affairs, you know, people who live not that way, let's say 99.9% of society. So obviously, you know, there's a time, as the Gemara itself said in the context of Rav Hamnuna, you know, Zman Tfilah L'Chud, Zman Torah L'Chud, there's a time for both of these. But, you know, what's so interesting that emerges from here is that in this kind of ideal structure, you can describe Tfilah as Chai Sha'a and Torah as Chai Olam. Let me just highlight it a different way. Whereas nobody ever challenge the supremacy of learning above all Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, there are those, the Ramban, Nachmanides prominently amongst them, and I admit in the dispute with Maimonides, a dispute with the Rambam, nonetheless Nachmanides is of the view that davening every day is not a mitzvah. It's a rabbinic enactment, it came from the rabbis, but on the Torah level, the Torah does not demand of you that you daven every day. The Torah demands that you daven when you have a crisis. Because in a crisis, it's appropriate to respond through prayer. Would the Ramban have ever conceived, I mean ever, that Torah study was not a daily mitzvah? So there's a hierarchy there. Again, this notion of relating to God, first and foremost on the normative plane, to study His laws, to do what He tells us to do, and to pray as a way of relating to Him, but through that lens. It's not in a casual, and not just casual, but it's not a relationship that should be viewed through any lens other than a normative one. Remember, that's what the Medrash said, that those who are not chaviv in divrei Torah, those who don't place Torah on a pedestal, their tzvila itself is a toeva. And, you know, nothing against hippies, but it's like a very, it's an anti-flowing, you know, it's referred to, you know, people who are flowy today, that's like a new adjective. Meaning that, you know, this idea of, you know, remember Rav Amital's Zichrona Livracha? Used to get very upset. There was a song that became popular in recent years. It's the best way I can explain this. It's a bizarre song, which the words are, I don't know what all the words, I just know the chorus. What's that? It says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Anachnu Ohavim Otcha. And meaning, God, you know, we love you. And he said, Ma'aseh HaKadosh Baruch Hu Anachnu Ohavim Otcha. He thought that was bizarre. What is this? It's like some kind of, you know, God, you're the man? God, you know, that's not a Jewish... No, there is such a thing as Avas Hashem, but there's also Yiras Hashem. And even if Avas Hashem has primacy over Yiras Hashem, which it does in certain contexts, in certain ways, you know, we don't express that. We express that deeply, subtly, with Snias. We don't say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Anachnu Ohavim Otcha. There's not, you know, we're first and foremost normatively centered. There's a kind of, a certain kind of gravity that, you know, you just don't go and spill it over. That's basically what Chazal are objecting to, is a religious experience that's intimate without being structured, disorganized, not precision-based. So those who are not chaviv in divrei Torah, who don't put that rigor, that structure, that precision, that system at the essence of their relationship with God, and they want to go straight for tefillah, that's a toeva. Because it's presumptuous, it involves an act of audacity on the part of man to go into God's inner chambers, as it were, without the proper preparing oneself. Without the mental and spiritual preparation that a normative commanded life implies. That's really the idea. So, you know, that That is a very profound Jewish concept. And again, like I said, if anybody spoke about this at great length, it was the Rav. And with respect to this issue of kind of an internal hierarchy of Torah over Tefillah, there's a remarkable Gemara in Brachos. It's a Gemara that's worth thinking about. It may be familiar to some of us, but I don't know how much we've dwelled on it. The Gemara in Brachos in Daf Vav says as follows. In preparation, I was thinking about this today in a way that I never thought about it before, in a strictly quantitative sense. Minayin la'asara, says the Gemara, shem ispalin sheshchina imahem. Shenemar alukim nitzav ba'daseel. 10 people who daven, and we learn it out from Sukkim, it's guaranteed that the Shechina will be there. This is one of the reasons that we're so insistent on having a minyan. A minyan brings God's presence, as it were, into the davening, wherever they are. We say Hashem is always present in a shul. But then doubly so, like if you don't have a minyan, that's why it's better to daven in a shul, because we see a shul as a place where Hashem is present. But if you want to be sure that Hashem is present in tefillah, it has to be a tefillah satzibur. There are other good reasons to have 10 people. That way you can do Dvarim Shebedusha, you can have Kaddish, you have Barchu. That's why we work so hard to get minyanim here, even during the week. So Arthur, I'll tell you all about the fun. So if you have 10 people in the context of davening, you can be guaranteed that Hashem's presence in there. Presumably, if you don't have 10 people, so then you don't know. It could be that Hashem is there, but the Gemara only gives you this guarantee. Minayin la'asar Hashem ispalin sheshchina imahem 10. But then the Gemara, just a few lines later, and it's striking when you think about it, says, Minayim l'shnayim sheyoshim ve'oskim b'torah sheshchina imahem, and it quotes a pasuk, Mimayin sheafilu echad sheyoshim ve'osik b'torah sheshchina imo, b'chol ha'makom asher azkir et shmi avoy lecho ve'rachticha. So the Gemara says, what, about learning? If there's two people learning, God is, no question, he's present if one person is learning. So that's amazing. The Gemara is really saying, each of these statements is kind of interesting in its own right. But what's more interesting, undoubtedly, is when you put them next to each other. Prayer, for it to be, you know, guaranteed of the divine presence, 10. Study, 1. If that's not an important comparison between Talmud Torah and Tefillah, I don't know what is. And it's counterintuitive, you know, that you would think that, so study of Torah, you know, can you really say that the Shechina is there? I mean, it's a good exercise, it's a good way to know what the halacha is, but it's not what we would normally think about in terms of, you know, Western civilization's definition of spiritual. If you say the Shechina is there, that's what we mean by spiritual. God is present, spiritual activity. So study, you know, is that spiritual? It's not, but prayer, that's certainly spiritual. So if you would have somebody off the street write this Gemara, they would say, so if one person is praying, you can be sure that God is there. But maybe if 10 people are studying and it's really good studying, then maybe God is there. But it's the opposite. Prayer, you have no guarantee. Study of Torah, that's an automatic. Wow. So again, here you see this hierarchy in a different light emerging from the Gemara of just how, and again, this isn't to mean tefillah. This tefillah is, you know, usually important. It's a major part of a religious person's experience. It's something that we talk about a lot, you know, and we value a lot. But as important as it is, it's overwhelmed by Talmud Torah. And that's really what's emerging from these sources. As we said, a person who doesn't have a sensitivity to Talmud Torah, and Arthur's point here is crucial. And we're not talking about somebody who never was exposed. So of course all they have is tefillah. That's so basic. But somebody who doesn't respect, he doesn't have the sensitivity and the sensibility of approaching God through a normative structure, through halacha. So that then is tefillah, is a toeva, because it's presumptuous. And then when you compare them apples to apples, you have all this evidence which says, you know, various amoraim were getting antsy about the idea of compromising Talmud Torah for tefillah, and then here you have this Gemara, which says that Talmud Torah is this automatic rendezvous with the Shechina, whereas tefillah, you know, there you need certain prerequisites. I wanted to conclude by mentioning a favorite Rambam of mine. The Rambam, as I noted before, and here's where the Ramban, Nachmanides, parted ways with him. The Rambam believes that tefillah is a mitzvah. in the Torah. So if you claim that something's a mitzvah in the Torah, you need a pasuk. So there's no pasuk in the Torah which says you must daven every day. But what the Torah does say in a number of different places is u'lo'ovdo b'chol avavcham. You should serve God with all of your heart. The question is, what does that mean? You should serve God with all of your heart. So it was a tradition of the sages, as the Gemara in Tainis and Daf Beis, which says, u'lo'ovdo b'chol avavcham, eizohi avodah shebelev, what is worship of the heart? Haviyomer zotzvila, it must be that this is a reference to prayer. That's why the Rav's book on prayer is called Worship of the Heart. It comes from this Gemara. So that's what the Rambam says. U'lo'ovdo, that tells you that there's a concept of prayer on the Torah level. So the Rambam says as follows. This is in Sefer HaMitzvos. HaMitzvah HaMishas Hitchet Sivanu Lo'ovdo Yisala. Ve'afo pisha zehatzivoy hu gam kein minat zivuyim hakololim, kamo shebiyarnu b'shorash arvi. So even though it's generic, it applies to every area of life, hine yesh bo yichud, it does have a specific application, shehu tziva b'tzvila. God is commanding us here in this pasuk to daven every day. Again, that's the Rambam's view, not everybody agreed to it. V'lashon sifrei, ula avdo zo tzvila, to serve God, that's a reference to prayer. Then the Rambam just throws in a line here. You could miss it unless you were, you know, paying attention really closely. And when you read Rambams, every word is you got to pay attention. You got to read every Rambam three times. The Amru Gamkein Ula Avdo Zet Talmud. So the Rambam just throws it in. And lest you think that avoda, service of God, only means prayer, part and parcel of the same kiyum, of the same mitzvah, the same constellation, the same religious endeavor is to study. Wow. So avoda has two dimensions. It's first and foremost in this context tefillah, but it's also part of the same kiyum, part of the same engagement, the same religious endeavor is study, is Torah study. So what's so remarkable here is that even in the context that the Rambam is playing up the significance of tefillah, he is, after all, making the argument that tefillah is a mitzvah d'oraisa, davening every day is a mitzvah d'oraisa, he also puts in the notion of serving God through study. Lest you think that this is the only way to serve God. No. There's also the role of study, and you shouldn't see them as separate. In other words, just like it's obvious to us that prayer is a way of engaging God directly, we should always remember that we're rendezvousing with God, and as we saw in the Gemara, maybe even more so when we're studying. It's an amazing Jewish concept. That when you study, you're actually engaged in a spiritual experience. We started with this idea of, you know, how bizarre is this pasuk in Mishle, you know, in quotation marks. We're saying that one who isn't interested in study and wants to pray, that's a toeva. I mean, how could he conceive of such a thing? But once you've, you know, worked through all the sources and you see our normative bias, our bias towards relating to God through the prism, first and foremost, of God as our commander. And the only way to meet him as a commander is, of course, to know the laws. As the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Einam Haaretz Chassid, a person who's not learned, who doesn't try to be learned, who doesn't try to, you know, again, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, so this is just a general observation. Person who doesn't value study can't possibly have meaningful religious experience. So that gives you a little bit of a context for what Shlomo is talking about. Meser Osmo Mishmoa Torah, somebody who's not interested, who rejects the religious experience through Torah, Gam Tfilaso Toeva. So his prayer is an abomination because it reflects arrogance and it reflects the idea that he thinks he can approach God almost on equal terms, as it were. Whereas, you know, our perspective is just the opposite. That the primary spiritual experience is that of study. Study of God's eternal truths. And prayer is crucial. You know, whether or not one believes it's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray every day, it's certainly a mitzvah d'rabbanan. And it allows us, as the Rambam say, to approach God. But in the same breath, the Rambam says, don't forget that study also has this effect. Lest you think that, you know, prayer can accomplish something that study doesn't. That's a very powerful perspective that we have, a uniquely Jewish perspective on what spirituality is all about. In the world, out there, and certainly in Eastern cultures, the notion of spirituality and the intellect as oppositional forces, as in tension with each other, is basic. That is a basic premise of certain cultures and philosophies, that intellectualism, rigor, and spirituality are always in tension with each other. Whereas the Jewish approach is that intellectualism is the gateway towards a meaningful spiritual existence, rigor and precision. Obviously, the more that you believe this, the more emphasis you put on education in general. And here I recall, let's take Dana's question a second, here I recall the statement of the Vilna Gaon, is that anybody who's deficient in any area of general knowledge, he was a mathematician. So, I don't know if everybody has to be a mathematician, it's a little daunting, but mathematics, science, music, he spoke about, will be missing a hundredfold in Torah.
Who was this you said that?
The Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon. Sorry, but go ahead, you had a question.
It's good to know.
I didn't even plant that for you. But the notion of education, of training of the mind, is so crucial. I want to note that two things. In this connection, one of the approaches, Nadav and Avihu, the two eldest sons of Aharon HaKohen, die. And one of the opinions within, we don't know exactly what their sin was. It says, "Behakrivam eish zara," they brought a strange fire. And one of the approaches in Chazal, this is based on the next passage in the Torah, God gives a warning about serving drunk. Don't drink and serve the avodah. Doing the avodah while under the influence, while intoxicated, so it's a death penalty. So what's this all about? So, of course, the explanation is precisely this. The idea of suppressing the intellect through substances, any narcotics, and serving God without being in full control of the intellect is a non-starter. Because we approach God first and foremost through this kind of rigorous system. That's so basic. So the notion of an orgiastic religious experience where it's suppression, and you could take this a long way, reveling in all kinds of drunken stupors and, getting high to get... What's that?
In the pagan times, that's what they did.
Precisely. That was the pagan experience. That was what it was all about. The Rav speaks about that at great length. 100%, Susan. So that's why it's such an offense. And I just will put it in context. And you don't have to take it this far, but just to conclude with one story, this might be often referenced in Halachic Man. So one of the most famous stories in Halachic Man, this will conclude, that underscores this point, is Rabbi Salvechik wrote that when he was a young boy, on Yom Kippur afternoon, apparently they had a break. I think it was Yom Kippur. I don't think it was Rosh Hashanah, if I remember correctly. Apparently, they had a break in the Rav's town also. Okay, so they had a break. So what were people doing? People were saying Tehillim. And so what did he do? So he said Tehillim with everybody else. So his father comes up to him and says, Berola. That's his middle name is Yosef Dov Salvechik. So in Yiddish, Dov Berola. He says, Berola, if you want to serve God, study the Talmud. And he hands him a Gemara. So what does that mean? Well, of course, saying Tehillim is also serving God. But what he meant to say is this notion that we've been developing tonight is that first and foremost, relate to your Creator through His laws. If you want to understand what Yom Kippur is all about, understand the laws of Yom Kippur. And then engage in tefillah. But the tefillah has to be built on the basis of understanding God through His laws. So again, I want to conclude where we began with Arthur's excellent caveat, which is that, of course, this isn't meant to undermine the centrality of tefillah. And certainly is it not, it's not meant to close any doors in the face of those who don't have access to Torah study. That would be a terrible idea. It would be halachically wrong and it would be morally wrong. The point really is, though, to understand for ourselves that the primary plane, and here I quote Rav Lichtenstein, the primary plane on which we relate to our Creator is that He is our mitzvah, He is our commander. He gave us a charge, a complex series of charges, and that we have to do our best, our very best, to try to adhere to that. And we relate to Him in that way. We don't approach Him absent that context. We don't approach Him on equal ground, so to speak, from the same line of vision. But we approach Him as those who are commanded, and then we build a relationship off that.